Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Robert Kerr. I'm chairing this session, which is called Trauma, What's in a Definition? If that's not what you're here to see, then you're in the wrong room. I have two speakers I'm proud to introduce. Firstly, Bill Mundy. Dr. Bill Mundy is presently the Chief Medical Officer for Munich Re Australia, a position he has held since July 2012. As way of background, Bill qualified from Cape Town University in 1987, continued postgraduate studies as a registrar at Wits Medical School in Johannesburg. Bill joined the insurance industry in 1997, and since then he has acted as CMO both in insurance and reinsurance in the South African and Australian markets. Bill enjoys knowledge transfer and keeping the insurance industry abreast of advances in medicine. And also, I'd like to introduce Chris. Chris Boundary is currently in the role of leader, client quotes at Munich Re Australia, responsible for pricing activity across retail and direct clients. Prior to relocating to Sydney in 2014, Chris held the role of director, individual reinsurance with Munich Re Canada. Chris has over 10 years of experience in the life insurance industry in Canada and Australia, across both direct insurance and reinsurance markets. Chris is a fellow of the Canadian Institute of Actuaries and a fellow of the Society of Actuaries and holds a bachelor's degree in honours actuarial science from the University of Waterloo.
Right, are we ready to go?
Yep.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me with the microphone? All good in the back? Yes, yeah, so on behalf of Chris and myself and Munich Re, we'd like to thank the Actuaries Institute and the Financial Services Forum for the invitation to speak this afternoon. It's a very topical issue, and I'm very pleased to see so many people in the room today. But as a medic with all so many actuaries in front of me, it's a bit daunting, obviously. And so I think of me as a support act for Chris. Okay. So I need to get you going. I want to get your endorphins going and your enkephalins going so that you're ready for the main act when it happens. Okay, and that will be Chris. But if I have to use... No. So no pressure on Chris whatsoever. Okay, but if I have to use one word to describe what I'm trying to talk about and get through, it's sustainability. Okay, and I work full-time in the insurance industry as a medic, and so obviously I'm going to have a medical hat on, and I'm going to use a little bit of medical jargon, which I'll try to go through and make it as easy as possible. So forgive me for that. So let me see if I get the technology right. Okay, so some of you in the room must have been touched by the recent social media case, okay, around a trauma definition, and I thought you'd find this extremely interesting. So just 12 days ago, just when you thought it was safe to get back into the water, this article occurred in the Journal of the American Medical Association and the Cardiology Journal, the case for a revised definition of the third universal definition of myocardial infarction. So the industry's all just moved to this third universal definition, and 12 days ago, now they've decided that perhaps we need to review it. So I put a smiley face and an unhappy face there. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Okay, but the one thing that is sure is that the definitions will always continually change and we'll have to keep reviewing them. Okay, good. All right. So this is what I want to go through. So the boat has been rocked with the recent trauma definition. And it really raises the question of, does one size fit all? Okay, and since this social media case, there's been a movement, a larger movement, to pay 100% based on the universal MI definition. Okay, so that's important, and that's happened within the last month. Okay, I'd like to talk about trauma definitions from a medical perspective. And there is a difference between academic and insurance definitions, so a little bit about that. Thoughts on myocardial infarction and cancer and severity-based trauma. So I just want to watch my time because we have to be quite careful with that. Let me just get that organized. Okay. So, it's difficult for me to try and put up in pictures mild, moderate, severe cancer, mild, moderate, severe stroke, or a mild, moderate, and severe heart attack. So I tried to use an analogy of a car crash. Okay. And I'm not being trite, because I'm sure every one of us in this room has been touched by these conditions in our own families. Okay. So what I am seeing, what I'm seeing really is a broad spectrum of strokes and MIs and cancers being treated the same and paid the same way when I act as a CMO looking at claims. And before I go any further, we must recognize in the room and acknowledge and pat ourselves on the back that we pay $50 million a day in claims in the life insurance industry. That was a stat that came out last week. Okay. But let's have a look at these. So, for those of you who are squeamish, the bottom one on the right, the person's not dead, they're just not very well. Okay. All right. And the lady on the front top is probably the best driver, because she didn't have a major crash, but she's still horrified. Okay. So, we have no difficulty paying cases such as the bottom on the right, both bottom cases, or even the top one, the bumper bashing on the top on the right. But I'm seeing more cases of the top on the left being treated the same as the bottom picture on the right. Okay. And by this, I see a stroke recovering in 3 days, getting a $2 million payment. I see an infarct that gets into a hospital cardiac unit within 2 hours, having a stent put in, having reperfusion, having no loss of functionality of their cardiac function, being paid $2 million. I see a stage one thyroid cancer being paid $600,000. Okay. And this, with my medical hat on, is worrying me. Okay, so, look, trauma definitions, they're difficult. They're not easy. But ideally, they need to meet the medical, financial, biopsychosocial components of the defined event. And I'm seeing a widening disparity between some of the payments that we're paying and the true impact of that event on the person from all considerations. Okay. They must be objective and understandable. And yes, we struggle still. If you take the third universal heart attack definition, it's difficult to understand. Okay, we've got work to do still. Okay, there must be robust, sustainable, and there must be an alignment of interest of all parties. And I'm beginning to see a misalignment of interests. Okay, I think they must be acceptable to the insurance industry, and I've highlighted and sanctioned by specialist external resources. So perhaps we need to really spend more time getting our definitions sanctioned by specialist bodies outside of the industry. And I think there'll be less conflict. I think there's work to be done still there. Okay. If they're linked to an exact academic definition, it has to be reviewable, because as you've seen from the first slide, you know, they're changing all the time. Okay. And ideally, they shouldn't incorporate very specific treatment modalities, as treatment protocols probably change faster than disease definitions anyway. Okay, is that all making sense so far? Right, so looking at academic and insurance definitions, maybe I was a bit over-optimistic with the smiles of the insurance people. Give me a smile, let's see. Yeah, I was over-optimistic. All right. So, the MI universal definition, this is what it looks like. I've preceded it. It's not word for word. This is what the industry has adopted. Okay. I don't have a problem with that at all. I think it's great, but what I have a problem is that we're paying the same amount for all infarcts. Okay. That's the problem. Not all infarcts are the same. So the myocardial universal definition, the diagnosis of a myocardial infarct in a clinical setting, that's great. We need a specialist, a cardiologist, to actually say you have had a heart attack. That is the most important line of that definition. Okay. The rise and fall, so something dynamic in biomarkers, and preferably troponin above the 99th percentile. 100 people in the street, 99 will be below that cutoff figure and one will be above it. Okay, all right. And then at least one of the following. So there's a choice of five, which is good, because it gives the assessor the ability to look at all the various information and decide whether they've hit the definition. But the first one is the most subjective. Symptoms of ischemia. Now, symptoms of ischemia is shortness of breath, sweating, and chest pain. I have two of those now presenting to you. So, all right. So it's the easiest and it's the most subjective. Okay. And it actually sort of negates or lowers the importance of the ECG changes because you don't actually have to meet those. You have to have the diagnosis of an infarct, and sometimes that can be difficult. It's not always black and white. The rise and fall of these troponins and symptoms of ischemia. Okay, and what's happening in medicine is that tests are becoming more sensitive. So if you look at this graph, you'll see that the sensitivity of troponin is increasing by a factor of 10 every couple of years. And that is really great news, because if you look at the bottom, you'll see that we'll be able to pick up infarcts at a lot earlier stage, just in a couple of hours. If you can pick up an infarct in a couple of hours, you can initiate the treatment. Okay, and if you initiate the treatment, you prevent the damage. Okay, so what it means is you're improving mortality and then you're improving morbidity at the same time. So in fact, mortality for heart attack is improving at 4 to 5% per annum. Okay, so you can see that with these increasing sensitive tests that we're having an impact. And it's shown in the next graph. It's really, that's the mortality. And Australia beats a lot of countries in the improvement in mortality from myocardial infarct. And the same is happening with morbidity as well. Okay. And so people are getting the correct treatment earlier. They have a less of a dramatic impact on their lives, and they're being paid all the same. Okay. So that's the mortality and the morbidity. Obviously, for you, the actuaries in the room, pricing and so forth, the incidence rate of myocardial infarction is important. Are these increasingly sensitive tests now picking up more infarcts, or are we just picking up the same infarct at an earlier stage? And it's probably a combination of both. Okay, we may be picking up smaller infarcts we may never have picked up before, or we're just picking up the same infarct a lot earlier. Okay. And it comes an interesting pricing issue, how to work that out. Okay, so when this first test came out in 2007, the medical journal said, well, there's going to be a 20-odd% increase in the incidence of myocardial infarction. Okay, which is quite daunting when you're trying to look at pricing and build in trends and so forth and look at the impact. But actually, it's quite interesting what's happening. So this is Australian stats. Obviously, coarse data for you actuaries in the room. But you'll see the absolute number of infarcts sort of peaked in 2010. But then if you look at against the population, you look at an incidence rate per mil, if these blood tests came out in 2000, 2007, 2008, that actually peaked then in 2.65 per mil. And since then, the trend actually has been... It seems to be coming down, even with an aging population. So it's more complicated than that. And probably what's happening in Australia is that people are addressing their smoking, their blood pressure, their cholesterol. So the number of infarcts is coming down, and that's mitigating the increase in the sensitivity of the tests. Okay. Also, people are being being treated before they infarct, when they have angina, when they have the warning symptoms. So it's all good news. Okay. Yes. Right. So a little bit of medical jargon just about infarcts. Okay, so in the past, we were very reliant on ECGs to make the diagnosis of infarcts. And if you look at those two heartbeats on the left of the slide, and the first is a normal heartbeat on an ECG. And then you'll see this one. Has there been an infarct? Can you see that elevation there? That is called an ST elevation, an infarct or a STEMI. And prior to the 1990s, that's all we really could pick up on ECGs and with our less sensitive blood testing. And so the heart attack had to advance to quite a stage for the ECG to go up, and then we could make the diagnosis. But with new sensitive testing and so forth, we're actually able to pick up infarcts before before that happens. And they're called non-STEMIs or non-ST elevated infarcts. And it's very interesting to see what's happening. So STEMIs are going down and non-STEMIs are going up, and troponin, the sensitive troponin, is certainly aiding in that. In the short term, someone who has a STEMI, the mortality is higher, but in the long term, if they survive, they'd actually do as well as a non-STEMI. Okay, but it's just interesting the dynamics of how this is all changing. So, with the debate that's happened recently, older myocardial infarct definitions excluded the smaller troponin levels before being a smaller infarct, and they used a cutoff of around about 600 nanograms. So this figure here, these would have not reached a threshold for payment, and they represent about 19% of all infarcts, or these. Or 36% of these smaller non-STEMIs. Some of these, or at least 70% of these, will have had a partial payment for an angioplasty, and some of them would have had a full payment for a coronary artery bypass graft anyway. But now, what's happened in reaction to the social media event is that this is now, we pay the same amount for all infarcts. And look at the difference. So an infarct here would be above 10 nanograms, and a good going infarct in the fourth quartile is between 85,000 and half a million. Okay, so the difference between 10 and half a million, but we're lumping them all together and paying the same. And as you use smaller troponins, the waters tend to muddy a little bit, because the troponin is caused by damage to the heart cells. But it's not only heart attacks that damage heart cells. All those up there can damage the heart. And some of those can cause chest pain, and some of them can make you feel sweaty and nauseous and so forth. So a good example is myocarditis. And so when you get to the lower levels of troponin, you may have an elevated troponin, you may have ECG changes, you may have the symptoms. It becomes difficult to know whether it's an infarct or not. So all of this has a number of consequences. Excuse me if I'm going through quite fast. I just want to keep time for the main event. All right. So what are the implications? Okay. So more sensitive testing is picking up infarcts at an earlier stage. This is great news from a mortality and morbidity perspective. Okay. It was postulated that more sensitive testing will increase incidence in the diagnosis of MI, but there's more to that. You've got to look at the lifestyle changes and so forth. Okay, so there's other mitigants to think about. The MI definition is softened due to a more sensitive troponin and less restrictive ECG changes, and the increased sensitivity in troponin has muddied the waters at low levels to know whether you're dealing with an infarct or not. And what have we done about it? Well, we've just said now we're going to pay 100% for all infarcts. Okay, we've become more lenient in the last month. Right. So let me just give you a few more slides on another one size fits all. Cancer. Okay. And once again, we use the same analogy. Okay. Now, this is the change in age and standardized incidence rates of cancers in Australia. The top one is thyroid cancer. So from 1982 to 2014, the incidence of thyroid cancer has increased by 287%. Okay. That is the relative survival of all stages of thyroid cancer over a 20-year period. It means a hospital stay of 1 to 2 nights, thyroid replacement therapy, a daily tablet. You may need radioactive iodine, which is 1 to 2 days in hospital. You don't usually have external radiotherapy, and you don't usually have chemotherapy. Absolutely excellent survival rates, and they can get $2 million as well, because all cancers, we only exclude things like basal cell carcinoma and very early stage cancers for, say, prostate. Okay. With screening, we're seeing that cancers are being picked up at an earlier stage anyway. Australia's excellent with their screening programs, so this is breast cancer, and you'll see the blue columns. Those are breast cancers picked up at an earlier stage because of screening, versus the red columns, which are cancers that would be picked up without screening. So without screening, breast cancers get picked up at a later stage. The earlier stage you pick up cancer, the bigger the chance of cure. Okay, so, and you'll see that from that slide, the CA, this is sort of Bible of data on cancer is that nearly half of all cancers are picked up at stage one anyway. So if you look at this, you think, well, doesn't this lead itself to severity-based trauma, where you pay a lower amount for a lesser severe cancer and a higher amount for the more severe? Okay, so what I want to say is, do you want to pay on an event or a diagnosis, or do you actually want to pay on its impact? And I think this is a question we really have to think. And I'm worried about the sustainability when we pay minor events as tests become more sensitive, the same amount as major events. Okay, so just with severity-based trauma, it's not a new concept. It's already in place. We pay early stage prostate cancer or melanoma a lower amount, but it's been eroded by the recent social media case. It aligns payment to impact. It would need input from specialist affinity bodies to make sure that we get these wordings right around the severity. It would prevent windfall payments and would aid maintaining sustainability and affordability of the product. So I have done my medical component. So now over to the specialists. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill. Alignment, customer understanding, and one size doesn't fit all. Those were some of the themes that I picked up throughout Bill's medical perspective on the current definitions in the trauma market. The next portion of the presentation I'd like to go through is looking at those now in terms of what they mean for trauma insurance itself, as well as to pass the buck to the room to get the discussion going on how we might be able to move forward past these challenges. So when Bill was saying I was the main event, he was actually lying to you. It will actually be when we kick off the discussion in the room, because we're very interested to hear about what everyone else in here has to say about the issues raised. The first slide I wanted to show you captures a range of different benefit triggers that might be able to be used for setting trauma insurance definitions. So if we're going back to the analogy raised by Bill, starting from the left to the right, we've got sort of our fender bender minor accidents on the left, moving over to the fatal or very serious car crashes on the right. Basically, what could happen is you could set your benefit trigger for your trauma insurance definition at any point along this spectrum, and whichever point you choose is going to have an impact on the consumer as well as the entire market. So I wanted to take a look at some of the different factors we might use to figure out where is the best place to set that definition. If we step back and look at a definition of insurance, going back to basics, the definition of insurance, or a definition of insurance, is being able to, is a financial risk management vehicle that allows individuals to pass financial risk or of possible future loss to an insurance company in exchange for premiums. So keeping that in mind and looking at, again, the severities that you might experience with a different condition, you can see that as you move from left to right on this slide, you increase the alignment with the client's insurance needs. Also implied by that is the probability of the event occurring. So if it's very severe, the probability would be much lower. We'll also reduce the cost. So similarly to the top, you're going to have costs or premiums decreasing as you move from left to right and setting where you set your benefit trigger. Another principle of insurance we like to refer to is looking at the person's position following the claim. So in terms of a basic principle that we look at, a policyholder should not be in a better position following a claim than they were before the claim occurred. Where a benefit is paid that exceeds the insurance need, you actually end up in a situation where policyholders may have incentive to actually look for ways to access those benefits, and that could lead to an increase in anti-selection. So we thought it was important to raise that as well. And the last point we also have to keep in mind, and this is, what do the consumers actually think they're buying? What do they understand the benefit to be? And keeping alignment with that will help to reduce any reputation risk that goes along with the product. Best interest duty is often quoted in terms of saying which definition is best for the consumer, so I wanted to keep in mind over the next few slides what each definition might mean for the end consumer. So I'm going to look at three possible places where we might be able to set the definitions along this spectrum. The first definition I'm going to talk about is a definition set where the benefit is only payable in the most severe cases. So if we're looking at insurance need, it's indisputable that there is an insurance need if it's an extremely severe case. So that's good. It's aligned with an insurance need. The probability of such event occurring would be fairly low, so the cost and the premium, therefore, would also be fairly low. In some cases, that could be a good solution if the consumer understands what they're buying, but I think everyone in the room will agree in most cases, you're going to be looking to be misaligned with what policyholders might be expecting from their cover. So that's a challenging situation to go down. The next case I wanted to look at is one where the 100% benefit or the maximum benefit is paid out in all cases. So this is the case where it doesn't matter the severity. You're looking at an event occurring rather than the impact of event, and all policyholders would receive the same benefit. In this case, you would have lots of claims being paid out, but there will be cases where people will receive benefits that exceed the insurance need for that policyholder. At Munich Re, we were interested to find out more about this, so we took a look at a subset of our claims experience, and in particular, we looked at claims on trauma riders on disability policies, where we had access to information not just about the trauma event, but also about the amount of time the individual took off of work. While trauma is not an income replacement policy, looking at the amount of time off work does give us some indication about how much their life was affected by the trauma event. What we found was very interesting. We found that looking at the claims that we reviewed, 43% of all of the claims reviewed were off work for less than 4 weeks of time. In addition to that, 24%, or included in that is 24%, who were off work for less than 1 week. A cynic might say that these individuals have won the trauma lottery, and they are certainly in a better financial position following the claim event than they were prior to the claim event. In addition to that, we also looked at the average claim amount. For the policyholders in total that we reviewed, the average claim amount was $93,000. For the policyholders or the claimants who received a benefit and were back at work within a week, the claim amount on average was $106,000. So there's actually a little bit higher for that subset. If we flip back to the different factors that I was looking at before, you can see that in the case where 100% is paid out for every claim, there is misalignment with the insurance need that came through in the review that we did. In addition, there is some evidence that there could be anti-selection occurring within that group, with the higher benefits being paid to the lower impact claims. Penetration in the insurance industry is still fairly low, and when we look at affordability, this is a major factor in determining whether or not the coverage is accessible for the general population, as well as whether or not existing policyholders are able to retain their cover until the point when a claim is required or an event occurs. Some insurers have shown that the average age of lapse is actually earlier than the average age of claim, which may leave some claimant or some policyholders without cover at the time when they experience a significant health event. Ultimately, what's best for the consumer is that they actually have insurance in place at the time that a significant health event occurs. And this is why, when I look at this definition, I don't necessarily think that this is best for the consumer either. The last case that I wanted to take a quick look at is one that tries to align benefit amount payable that reflects the severity of the event that's occurred. In this case, you're going to see a cost that's reduced because benefits are being paid according to the need. And that's something that I think, as Bill was mentioning as well, seems to be something that could be the best thing for the consumer as well. Now, I've probably given you enough about my thoughts, so I want to flip this over to the room. So if everyone can get out their smartphones, if you have one in your pocket, there's an address at the bottom of the screen there. So if you go to that web address on your phone, it'll come up with a little voting device so that we can actually go through the next the remainder of the presentation to hear your thoughts as well. So in terms of where which definitions are best for consumers, we thought we'd start out with a quick case study. This address will be on every slide going forward, so don't worry if I flip the slide and you've missed it. The first question we wanted to put to the audience was, what role should trauma insurance play in a policyholder's life? So in this case, Mr. Smith has just been diagnosed with early-stage thyroid cancer. He is scheduled for surgery next week and will miss a number of days of work in order to recover. No other treatment is required, and he is expected to make a full recovery. What role should trauma insurance play for Mr. Smith? So option A is up to $2 million benefit. He's paid his premiums and is thrilled to receive the benefit. He is now in a much better financial position than before and has been seen shopping for Ferraris a few days following his surgery. A happy insurance customer indeed. Or should he receive a smaller benefit? The money would help Mr. Smith through the challenges following his diagnosis, but has not had a material impact on the financial position following his recovery. Or C, no benefit. The diagnosis has had very little impact on his life and therefore doesn't need an insurance payout. So I'll just let the votes come in. So just push on your keypad there, A, B, or C, and you can see the number increasing in the corner, so we'll just let that get a little bit higher before I move forward.
Is there a prize?
Is there a prize? There's no right answer. All right, I think it stopped going up. Oh, never mind. So in the market at the moment, the common definitions in this situation would pay out the full amount, the full $2 million. So I think this has stopped moving. So I'll give you the answer. So the answer is 60% have selected option B. I can't actually read that on here. 38% option C and 2% with option A. So you can see that the answers in the room are fairly misaligned with how the actual product would work in the market today. So we've raised a number of issues throughout Bill's session and my own around definitions and where to set them and what's the best thing for the market as well as the consumer. And so is there anything that we can actually learn from other markets? So obviously these challenges are not unique to Australia. What have other markets done to address this challenge? So one of the things we've seen happening globally is a move to standardize definitions. And what I've put up on the board is a few different markets that have moved to standardize definitions. Not going to go into this in detail, though I will talk a bit more about the Canadian situation at the end of the presentation. But what I'm most interested in to hear is what everyone in the room thinks about standardized definitions as a possible way forward in Australia. So the first question, we'll start nice and easy. Would standardized definitions, in your opinion, benefit the Australian trauma market? So again, if you want to get your phones out and place a vote, we'll just let that run up. All right. Oh, more people are voting this time. Everyone's excited about the last the last one. All right, I'll move it forward now. So we see 57% have said that they think this would be something positive to move forward with in Australia. 22% have said no, and 21% are not sure. So let's find out a bit more about the reasons why we think it might benefit or why what the concerns are in the market. So the next question that I wanted to ask the room is, what do you think would be the main benefit of standardized definitions in Australia? So for those of you who think it's a good way to move forward, what are your thoughts? There is also an other category here, so F is other. If you would like to submit your comment about what you think that other is, you can also do so on the app. If we get a lot of other votes, I can also read those out. The options for this question are A, reduced reputation risk, B, improved customer and advisor understanding, C, easier to price, D, higher sales, E, encourages innovation in product service rather than definitions, or F, other. All right, looks like it stopped going up. All right, so it looks like the most popular answer was improved customer and advisor understanding with 59%. 19% of you also thought it might help reduce reputation risk. The next answer was 14% for encourages innovation in product service rather than definitions, with small amounts going to the other answers. and no answers came through on the other. The next question that I want to ask the room are, what are your top concerns with standardized definitions? So for those of you who said no, this is your opportunity to let the room know why you think it's not a great idea. For this question, is it because A, it would restrict competition, B, it would be difficult to develop and keep current, or C, the complexity that would be introduced by having standardized definitions? And again, welcome to put in an option other as well. Right. It looks like everyone's voted. Oh, pretty mixed bag on this one. 44% said difficult to develop and keep current, 29% restricts competition, 13% complexity, and 14% were other. And again, I didn't receive any other answers. Right. The next question that we're going to look at is, if Australia were to move to standardized definitions, what level of standardization should be considered for these trauma definitions? The first answer here is a strict definition that would require a 100% payout across the market, a broad definition that would require a 100% payout across the market, or C, a broad definition, but allowing the percentage payout for that definition to be selected by the insurer, or multiple severities defined across each condition. And again, there's an option for other if you have other ideas that you think should be considered. Looks like we've almost got everyone's votes in. All right. So the answers for this question. We can see 56% think D, multiple severities should be defined across each condition. 20% each for a strict definition with 100% payout, or a broad definition with a payout that's can be chosen by the insurer, with a small percentage saying broad definition with 100% payout. And then the last question that I wanted to put to the room was, who would benefit the most from having standardized definitions being brought into the Australian market? Would it be A, insurance companies and reinsurance companies, B, consumers, or C, advisors, or D, some other group? Looks like we've got all the votes in, just about. All right. And so we've got 53% saying consumers would be ultimately the winners out of the standardized definition, so that's positive to hear, with 20% saying insurance companies and 18% saying advisors. There's also quite a few who have indicated other. Let's see if anyone's put any comments in. I'm not seeing any come through, so I'll assume they don't want to share with the room. So the last thing that I wanted to walk through today was to give a bit of an overview of my personal experience working in a market that did have standardized definitions. So I was going to just walk through a quick case study from my experience in the Canadian market. Benchmark definitions came to the Canadian market in 2007. They were introduced by a group of representatives across insurance companies and reinsurance companies, and it involved representatives from medical backgrounds, underwriting, claims, actuaries, product, who all got together to come up with what definitions should be to move forward with. In order to come up with these definitions, there was an agreement about how they should be used in the market and what their purpose was. The main points that they came up with in terms of putting that together were, one, that the definitions were being standardized for the purpose of keeping up with medical and keeping alignment with medical, so that the definitions were relevant and up to date. So they weren't meant to be for competitive positioning, but purely from a medical and consumer perspective. The second point was that material changes from the standardized definitions were appropriate, but minor changes where they were just wording changes within the definition were discouraged in order to avoid confusion around perceived differences in wording. The definitions themselves are not mandatory in Canada, but they have been adopted and continue to be used by most of the market. The Canadian Life and Health Insurance Association was tasked with maintaining these definitions, and they have scheduled reviews every 5 years. The first review was completed in 2013, with 8 definitions being updated at that point in time. Overall, 26 definitions are included in the benchmark definitions. From working with benchmark definitions and when they were introduced, the biggest benefit that I think was seen in the market is that they're much easier to understand for the consumers and the advisors. And one interesting learning that came out of introducing the benchmark definitions is that by providing consumers with a choice of which definition they could have was not necessarily a good thing, as consumers and advisors often didn't understand the differences between different medical terminology. So by giving them that choice was actually not a positive thing. So removing that confusion from the market allowed an easier sales process. Insurance companies focused on product and service as opposed to definitions, and advisors could focus on selling the value of the insurance rather than specific perceived wording differences between companies. After the product or the benchmark definitions were introduced, there was an increase in sales within the Canadian market, which has been attributed to some of that better understanding and maybe less complicated sales process. One of the challenges that is definitely worth also mentioning is that they are challenging to maintain. It's difficult to get everyone in the industry on the same page around where the definition should be set. And anytime updates are required, it can be a lengthy review process and feedback process in order to get that put in. My personal view from working in the Canadian market, is that the benchmark definitions were a very positive thing within the Canadian market. However, the Canadian market is very different than the Australian market, so I wouldn't be naive enough to suggest that it'll answer all the problems in this market. I think the Australian market is much more competitive than the Canadian market, and expect that there will be continuing ways to find differences in definitions in order to compete, and that will continue to be a challenge, I think, in this market as well. In conclusion, I think just to really quickly summarize the points through Bill and I's session, one size does not fit all when it comes to definitions. In considering what's best for consumers, I think accessibility and retention of insurance cover needs to be top of mind. Alignment with the medical industry needs to be also a priority to make sure that what's being covered makes sense, as well as standardized definitions should be a discussion point to see if that's a possible way to move forward. Any questions that anyone want to ask Bill or I?
If you've got any questions, can you please use the mic in the center of the room?
Just a quick question. How granular are the definitions you've got? You had so many different types of cancers, so how far down does it go?
From the Canadian market? That's a good question. They're set at a specific level, so there's no severities defined, and any partial payouts are also not currently standardized definitions, and there are other conditions that exist in the market that are also not standardized. So within each standardization, it's sort of set at where the maximum payout level would be, so more of a probably on the stricter side. Is that...
I just wanted to clarify one thing with what you mean by standard definition. Is it retrospective? So if I take out a policy in 2005 mm-hmm. and they or 2010, and it's based on the 2008 assumptions, and then you revise the definition in 2013. Is my policy revised, or is my definition retained as what it was when I took the policy out?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I think that's something that obviously in the Australian market would have to be discussed. In terms of the Canadian market, which is also similar, I believe, to the UK, where premiums are actually guaranteed on these products. So actually updating definitions is something that is not automatic and could be quite challenging and from a cost perspective, potentially not possible. So in the Canadian market, the definitions do not get passed back when they're updated. That would be up to the insurers to decide whether or not that was something they wanted to do. So there will always be the challenge of the historic definitions. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a big consideration for figuring out how you can standardize and move forward.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask a question. my background is I'm from the UK market, and it's introduced standard definitions a long time ago, but pretty much nobody offers just the standard definitions. Everybody offers massively more conditions and pays out a lot more. How is it working in the Canadian market?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in the Canadian market, and probably back to the point about how the market's quite a bit less competitive than the Australian market, is that nearly all insurers are using the standardized definitions with no adjustments, so completely as they're written. Which does make it a bit easier as a pricing actuary in that market and to review experience, but certainly not an expectation for Australia.
Has anyone else got any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to thank Chris and Bill in the usual way.